Morning. You want to turn in your Bibles to the book of Ecclesiastes. That's where we're going to spend our time today. Book of Ecclesiastes. I think that preachers are notorious for having hobby horses. It's almost, you could say peanut butter and, preachers and hobby horses are like peanut butter and jelly. I mean, they just go together. Don't get me wrong, I'm not putting peanut butter and jelly down. I could eat it every day. But it's probably not the best thing to serve to people every Sunday. But every once in a while, if you analyze yourself, you tend to go back to the same subject sometime. Maybe it's because, you know, it's something that's a problem in the society, and it's something you feel needs to be preached on frequently, or whatever. But one thing I find myself having a tendency to go back to a lot is the perils or the warnings, the dangers of fun and overindulgence in the things of this society, entertainment, and things like that. And you might interpret them as, if you see me going back to those things frequently, that maybe I think that a person shouldn't have any fun. That entertainment's just wrong completely. And that we all just sit around and be serious all the time. And it would be easy to justify preaching frequently about things like that, about the dangers of that. I mean, even in the reading that we just had, Jesus tells the story of the rich man and who saved up all of his goods and accumulated, he said, you know, you eat, drink, and be merry, was his phrase. Eat, drink, and be merry. And Jesus says, you know, your soul is going to be required of you tonight. So he had overindulged himself until the point of where he had lost focus on what really was of value and truly a treasure. And certainly our culture is very overindulgent. And so I could spend a lot of time talking about the risks of being overindulgent. But you shouldn't throw off the baby with bathwater, somebody might say. And there's one preacher in the Bible who recommends a wholehearted pursuit of pleasure and enjoyment. And that is Solomon. And today we're going to talk about what Solomon says about eat, drink, and be merry. Now, when we think about what Solomon's book all about, if I did a survey and said, what's Ecclesiastes? What do you know about the book of Ecclesiastes? Probably most people could remember what he says at the end, his conclusion. Fear God, keep his commandments, but that's the whole duty of man. And that's just about all we remember about the book of Solomon, or Song of Ecclesiastes. But there's a lot more in that than just that particular message. There are other things that he learned in his experience. And one of those, in chapter 8 and verse 15, is stated this way. So let's read this verse, chapter 8 and verse 15. He says, I commended pleasure. For there is nothing good for a man under the sun except to eat and to drink and to be merry, and this will stand by him in his toils throughout the days of his life, which God has given him under the sun. Now that catches your attention. Because that seems almost absolutely contrary to anything else in the Bible. Eat, drink, and be merry. That's the philosophy you ought to have. Well, Solomon learned that in his life, that we ought to eat, drink, and be merry and learn to enjoy the pleasures of this life. Now, we don't usually use that phrase because it tends to have negative connotations. People think you're talking about boozing it up, or going to parties, or living on the edge, and living without discretion. But there must be some type of appropriate way to understand this idea if Solomon recommended it to us. And I want us to think about that for a few minutes. Solomon was the king in Israel, David's son, who he gave the kingdom. Solomon was a good boy because of his desire for God to give him wisdom so that he could rightly judge God's people. God gave him wisdom and much more. He gave him riches and gave him wealth and gave him many great things. And Solomon for a time at least, probably a good king. Somewhere along the way, he went off, got off track. In fact, he broke every rule that Deuteronomy says a king shouldn't break. He accumulated wealth for himself and silver and gold, and they said you shouldn't do that. He accumulated horses and chariots from Egypt, which God said you shouldn't do that. And he married a lot of wives. So you take your pick, which one you think was his worst crime. We usually highlight that he had all the wives, but he broke every rule that God gave the kings of Israel. He went off track. And usually when we look at Ecclesiastes, the way it's normally understood is that it's a point in Solomon's life where after he went off track and did a lot of things he shouldn't do, and he kind of got back on track. He kind of looks back on his life and he said, these are the mistakes I made. These are the roads I experimented with. And don't do what I did, because it's a disaster. This is instead what you need to do. You need to fear God and keep his commandments. That's what man's life is all about. But in the midst of that book, he learned some things that he wanted to recommend to us. And this is one of them. And the first thing that I want to suggest, he says, eat, drink, and be merry. What does he do? He tells us that we're to enjoy life because it's a gift of God. I want us to look at that real quick. Look at chapter 2 and verse 24 through 26. Chapter 2, verse 24 through 26. He said, there's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? God is the giver of all good things. And when God made Eden, he didn't make a swamp. He made a beautiful place. Every tree he put in the garden was pleasing to the eyes and good for food. And so even in Eden at the beginning, the idea of, recreation, recreation, rest and enjoyment is almost inherent in that idea. God wanted man to enjoy and be blessed bountifully. God knew there were times that we need to rest. Put that in the laws of Israel. Life is not about work. Jesus even took his disciples away at times to rest and from their work that they did. And I always think about James' comment that every good thing given and perfect gift, or every good thing given and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights. Reminds us that nothing we have is not that we didn't receive from him. Everything we have we received from God. And the gift reminds us that it's undeserved. Now, whatever gifts we have, we ought to thank God frequently for those things that we have. But why tell us to eat, drink, and be merry? Why give us these temporal gifts and these blessings? I think Solomon explores that a little bit in his book of Ecclesiastes. And I want to suggest a few of those things, and if we run out of time, I'll just stop before I get to the end. But I'm going to suggest what things I noticed. Number one is that life is, generally speaking, not very fair. Life's not a bowl of cherries. Chapters 3 and verse 16 and 17. We'll look at what he says, and then we can certainly relate that to our day. But let's look at what he said first. He makes this observation. Furthermore, I have seen, this is under the sun, Solomon is making, this is his observations as he observed life, that in the place of justice, there's wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, there's wickedness. And I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man for a time for every matter and every deed is there. He looked for righteousness, he looks for good things, and he saw injustice. Looked for things that were good, and he saw wickedness everywhere. And then look again, he comes back to this subject, maybe because he's a preacher, and he tends to like to have hobby horses. But in this chapter 8, verse 10 through 14, chapter 8, verse 10 through 14, he says, so then I have seen the wicked buried, those who used to go in and out from the holy place, and they are soon forgotten in the city where they did this. This too is futility. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. And although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life Still, I know that it will be well for those who fear God and who fear Him openly. But it will not be well for the evil man, and he will not lengthen his days like a shadow because he does not fear God. He basically says in these two passages, he says life is not fair. It's very easy to get a very depressed or fatalistic view of life, I think. Some people have that. And I don't need to read the newspaper headlines to you or tell you what was on the news this morning to know that. Now, his example is something that was characteristic of his day, evidently, and that was there were priests who were just as corrupt as they could be. They operated in the temple. They came in and out of the temple in the holy place every day. And they appeared righteous, but really they were wicked. But when the guy died, they carry him out of the city and bury him, or they bury him in the city, I think, and he gets like a red carpet treatment. I mean, he's treated with great respect and great honor, even though, you know, really, he was wicked. And he goes on to say in verse 11 that there's no punishment for the crime. Looks like he didn't even get punished. Died, had a great life, wickedness, but he was a hypocrite. But he dies and nobody seems to do anything to him. So he's, and what happens because of that is other wicked men are strengthened to do more wickedness because he wasn't punished. Says that in verse 11. Other evil men, he says their hearts are given fully to do evil. Well, that's discouraging. That's frustrating to the man who is truly trying to do what's right, because he sees the injustice and he even sees hypocrites in the church. Is this not relative to 21st century? I mean, don't we see, you know, things like that happening? People that are ought to be behaving themselves and they're not. They look really nice at church and they look perfect, but then out in the daily lives they don't behave themselves the way they ought to. And so it's not, this is current, even though it's over 3,000 years old. Well, the preacher still thinks that it's better to fear God in the long run. It says in verse 12 and 13, he says, although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God and who fear Him, and it will not be well for the evil man. He kind of says eventually the man's going to get what's coming to him. He's going to come to him. It's better for you to do what's right now, though. But it's hard to tell when any good justice is going to come. You can't tell it by looking at it. You just don't know when it's going to come. Why does God allow injustices like this? Why does He allow and not deal with injustices now? Well, it may be just because He wants to learn, help us learn to trust Him and to recognize that we can't straighten out all of the injustices and things in this world. Chapter 3 and verse 18, back there again when we were reading the earlier passage, he said, I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. As he talks about those beasts there, the point is, we're not a whole lot different than the beasts in the sense that we can't straighten out the crooked roads in this world and undo all the injustices any more than an animal can. And that's a frustrating thing, but it humbles us. It realizes we are not in, helps us realize we are not in control. And since we can't expect things to work out fairly in this life, what should we do? Should we be despondent? Should we be inactive? Should we be bitter? Should we sit around and brood about all the injustices and mope around and just have a miserable life because things are unjust? Should we just dwell on it? He says no. Chapter 8, verse 15, he says, I commended pleasure, for there is nothing good for a man under the sun except to eat and drink and be merry. This will stand by him in his toils throughout the days of his life which God has given him under the sun. God is not against pleasure and entertainment or enjoyment. We're, in fact, supposed to use the blessings that He gave us in the midst of the toils of life, in the midst of the injustices. Our blessings are, in part at least, meant for the relief from the pressures and the injustices that are common to our world. But I think that's one of the reasons he's recommending that we enjoy life, because life's not a bowl of cherries full of injustice. But there's another thing he says, and that is that you don't know the future. Look, if you went back to chapter 3, verse 1 through 15. I don't have time to read all of this, but this is a... Well, yeah, there's another part of Ecclesiastes people know. It's this poem that was written. Verse 1, there's an appointed time for everything, and there's a time for every event under heaven. A time to give birth, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to uproot and be planted, or what is planted, a time to kill, a time to heal. And he goes on. You know that poem, probably, made popular by the birds years ago. But what this poem basically says is that men have little control over the events in life, of his life. We have little to say about many things. When they were born, or very little to say about the day we die. We have little power to change or affect the course of history. We do have some opportunities. We can build up or tear down. We have some opportunities in life. But really, ultimately, it is God who decides and controls history. That's what he means when he says there is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven. Or verse 11, he has made everything appropriate in its time. The point is, God is one who is running things. And we really don't have anything to say about it. The future is not in our control, ultimately. And humans are very limited. We really can't even figure out what God's going to do next. This is his world, and he's the one that's guiding and directing history. In view of that, what should we do? In view of the fact that that we can't control everything in this world, and things are something or things we can't decide and can't affect, he says in verse 15, or look down in verse 12 and 13, I know that there's nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. He says we need to, really, he says you need to learn to trust God and make the best of life. Enjoy the fruits of your labor. That's God's gift to you in an uncertain world, a world that you can't control. The future is not in our control. But he also recommends in this book that we learn to enjoy it now. That we need to seize our opportunity and enjoy what we have. Look back in chapter 11. When I was little, my grandfather used to have a phrase that he would use. He would always say, take it out of circulation. He lived through the Depression, so he knew what it meant to have nothing. And so once out of that depression, he began got a job and was able to make some income. He felt, take it out of circulation. And so he saved everything he made because there was a great fear that that might happen again. But it seems like Solomon's saying something different. He says, seize your opportunity. Look in verse 1 through 6. Cast your bread on the surface of the waters, for you will find it after many days. Divide your portion to 7 or even to 8, for you don't know what misfortune may occur on the earth. It's kind of like, don't put all your eggs in one basket. If the clouds are full, they pour out rain upon the earth, and whether a tree falls to the south or toward the north, wherever the tree falls, there it lies. He who watches the wind will not sow, and he who looks at the clouds will not reap. Just as you don't know the path of the wind and how the bones are formed in the womb or the pregnant woman, so you don't know the activity of God who makes these things. Sow your seed in the morning and do not be idle in the evening, for you don't know whether morning or evening sowing will succeed or whether both of them alike will be good. You can see the idea of our not knowing the future, that we don't know what's going to happen. You ever heard somebody say, make hay while the sun shines? A guy who stands out there and looks and he says, oh, it might rain today. Oh, there might be a storm coming. I better not plant. Well, that's not the way you live life. You need to go out there and work while you have a chance and do what you can because you don't know what's going to happen. And a lot of times people are very almost paralyzed because they don't know the future. But he says to these, here, it's not wise to hoard up the things that you have. You don't know what tomorrow will bring. You shouldn't be paralyzed about the unknown. But you should invest yourself because you don't know the future. And in this case, he's saying you need to enjoy your life. Enjoy the things that you have because you don't know the future. Chapter 3 and verse 12 and 13. And there's another thing he ties into that in this, and that is that man can't tell by what happens in this life if God loves him or hates him. Life is a mix of good and evil, and it's hard to know how to interpret that. Look in chapter 8 and verse 16. These are things that Solomon learned through his experience. They're inspired. The Lord had him write these things down. But they are for us to learn. Look in chapter 8 and verse 16. When I gave my heart to know wisdom, to see the task which has been done on the earth, even though one should never sleep night or day, I saw every work of God. I concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun. Even though man should seek laboriously, he will not discover. And though the wise man should say, I know, he says, you will not discover. Verse 9, chapter 9 and verse 1. For I've taken all this to my heart and to explain it, that righteous men, wise men, and their deeds are in the hand of God. And man doesn't know whether it will be love or hatred. Anything awaits him. And it's the same for all. The fate of one, the one fate for the righteous and for the wicked, for the good, for the clean, for the unclean, for the man who offers sacrifice, the one who doesn't offer sacrifice, as the man is, so is the sinner. As the sinner is, so is the one who is afraid to swear. He says a righteous man really doesn't know, based on what's happening around him all the time, whether God loves him or hates him, by trying to interpret the events happening around him. What did Job try to figure out? When terrible, horrible things happened to him, he thought that God was against him. He thought that he was God's enemy. It's not true. He wasn't. God permitted him to be tested, but he was a righteous man and not guilty of anything. But God didn't interpret that for him. So he was worried. What about Paul? Here's Paul that's worked and worked and worked and labored to preach the gospel. Then he gets to Rome. He gets on the island of Malta, and he gets snake bit. Now all the natives around him said, "That's justice. Justice is after you. You're going to die." It caught up with him. But he hadn't done anything wrong. But bad things happen, and you would know by that whether God's against you or for you. There's a lot of pain and suffering in this world that's hard to interpret. Hosea married a woman who was unfaithful to him. And in that case, pain was very educational to him, suffering. He learned through pain how God felt due to the adultery of Israel. There was a blind man that Jesus healed. And the disciples said, "Why is he blind? What did he do? Who sinned, him or his fathers?" And Jesus said, "Neither. This is for God's glory." Well, how would he have known that? You know, the point that I'm making is that we don't know by circumstances that happen in our life. We can't interpret those to know whether God's for us or against us. We have no prophet to come along and tell us that. And so how should a wise man respond in view of these kind of truths, this kind of world that he lives in? Well, look, if you would, in chapter 9, verse 7 through 10. He tells men, "Go then and eat your bread in happiness. Drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. Let your clothes be white all the time, and let not the oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with a woman who you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given you under the sun. For this is your reward in life and in your toil in which you have labored under the sun." It's kind of strange to hear him say, "Drink wine. Wear clean clothes. Put oil on your head." The ideas of joy, festivity, dress well-groomed, have a well-groomed appearance. Learn to enjoy life with your wife. Enjoy your marriage. What's he saying? Is he recommending we go out and drown our sorrows? That we booze it up? That we go to parties and live on the edge? I don't think he's recommending ungodly indulgence in anything, making pleasure our God. That would be completely contrary to the other things that Solomon has said. He says, even at the end of this book, in chapter 11 and verse 9, he says, "Rejoice, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be blessed or pleasant during the days of your young manhood. Follow the impulses of your heart and desires of your eyes, yet know that God will bring you into judgment for all these things." He recommends enjoyment, but he says you be careful about what you do, because God's going to bring you into judgment. Chapter 12, verse 13. The conclusion, what all has been said, is fear God and keep His commandments. This applies to every person, for God will bring every act into judgment. Anything which is hidden, whether it's good or evil. It doesn't make sense that Solomon is recommending ungodliness. Things that are indulgent, that goes beyond what God says. And he said many things in other places, such as Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 1. When he says, wine is a mocker, strong drink is a brawler. Whoever is intoxicated by it is not wise. We know those passages. We know in chapter 29, 23 of Proverbs, he has a very long excerpt about the dangers of wine and what it can bring and what it can cause. Chapter 3 and verse 29, who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of the eyes? Those who linger long over wine. Those who go to taste the mixed wine. He says, don't look on the wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. At last it bites like a serpent. It stings like a viper. Your eyes will see things. Your mind will utter perverse things. You will be like one who lies down in the middle of the sea, or one who lies down in the top of the mast. They struck me, but I didn't become ill. They beat me, but I didn't know it. When shall I wake? When shall I seek another drink? Solomon's not recommending ungodly indulgences here. It's very reasonable that he's just recommending that maybe diluted or table drink wine that was very common in that day, something that you couldn't get drunk on if you wanted to. But the message is, don't make your pleasure your God, but wholeheartedly enjoy without guilt the good gifts that God has given you in view of the kind of world that you live in. Why should you be so wholehearted about this? Look again back to Ecclesiastes and look in chapter 9. Another passage that might be a little bit more familiar to us. Verse 10 and 11. Chapter 9, verse 10 and 11. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For there's no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol, that is in the grave where you're going. It says, whatever you do, do it all your might, because you can't, you're going to die. You can't do any planning or enjoyment or work in the grave. And then look at verse 11. I again saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors, neither is the bread to the wise, or the wealth to the discerning, nor favor of men of ability, for time and chance overtake them all. You might be smart. You might be fast. You might be clever. You might be the best businessman in the world. But that doesn't matter. He says time and chance overtake all of us. We're not able to outdo life and some of its difficulties. So he says enjoy life. Enjoy it while you have it. Because you can't tell what's going to happen next. There's another thing, too, that he recommends. Don't try and make temporal gifts produce lasting fulfillment. Now look to chapter 5. Look to chapter 5, verse 10 through 19. Solomon would know. I think that Solomon's the writer of this book because the validity of the arguments are based on who it is who writes the book. And Solomon had every ability to enjoy all of the material things in this life, and he has the experience to give us counsel on those things. And he had lots of money. So here's his recommendation. He says in verse 10 of chapter 5, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This, too, is vanity. When good things increase, so do those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owners except to look on? Does wealth truly satisfy? What comes with more riches, does he say? Less sleep, more worry. He says in verse 12, the sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. He's always worried. Is his stocks going to fall? How's his investments doing? He'll stay awake at night planning, wondering how he can preserve himself. What can happen with riches? Look in verse 13 and 14. There's a grievous evil which I've seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment, and he had fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. Here's a guy who had everything, and he kept accumulating, kind of like the rich man. in Luke chapter 12. You accumulate it, but then he dies. And he loses everything in a minute. So, you know, they can, you know, it's a great illustration of the fleeting, the temporalness and the how quickly temporal gifts can be lost. What did the rich man get for all of his investments and all of his work? Look in verse 16 and 17. This is a grievous evil, exactly as a man is born, thus he will die. So what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? Throughout his life he also eats in darkness with great vexation and sickness and anger. What's the person get for all of his energy and hard effort into all of his investments? Misery, trouble, pain. He's sick from his work. He's angry over troubles that come with that. You can just see that all the futility of trying to make these temporal gifts a lasting fulfillment, make them really satisfied. That's not what they were designed for. The very mistake he made was in expecting these things to produce something it was never designed to produce. Kind of like the person who buys a refrigerator and goes to the grocery store and he gets some steaks. He really, just really wants to eat those steaks. And so he puts them in, closes the door, and he sits there and he waits. Waits an hour and he opens it up. Still raw. He closes it and sits there and waits another hour. He's just mouth just watering. He can't wait to get those steaks. Opens it, still raw. What's the problem? He's asking that machine to do something it wasn't designed to do. And it's the same thing when someone tries to make something, temporal gifts in life, produce something that they were never designed to produce. This rich man is seeking to have happiness and fulfillment in his riches, but that's not what they were designed to produce. What is he seeing? What is he seeing? What did he learn? Verse 18 through 20 in chapter 5. Here's what I've seen to be good and fitting, to eat and drink and enjoy oneself in all one's labor, in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him, for this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and to rejoice in the labor. This is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. He says, enjoy what you have. He doesn't condemn riches. Don't say anything wrong with having the riches. God blessed Solomon. He gave it to him. It was a gift of God. I mean, you might think that he would say the best thing to do is to have nothing to do with pleasure, but it's really just the opposite. He says, enjoy the blessings that you have. God has empowered you. But he's very repetitive, isn't he? He says, you know, but be careful that you don't try to make those things your God. Don't make them do something that God never intended them to do. And then he does one other thing. He says that self-reliance causes one to hate life. Your reliance on your own ability and efforts will not produce happiness. They won't produce contentment. You ever heard somebody compliment some other person? You say, what do you think about so-and-so? And they say, oh man, he works so hard. I mean, he is a worker. I mean, he's always working. He just works and works. And boy, he's really a hard worker. Okay. Well, Solomon was a hard worker too. But sometimes people who work and work and work and work and work are trying to make that work produce happiness and contentment. Solomon sought, if you go back to chapter 2, and especially, he sought after pleasure with all his heart. He sought after wisdom and knowledge with all of his heart. He put everything he had into accumulating wisdom. He worked really, really hard. And you can see that reflected in chapter 2 at the beginning when he says, come now and I will test you with pleasure. So I enjoy yourself. And behold, it was futility. And of laughter, he said, it's madness. What does it accomplish? And he said, I explored of my mind how to stimulate my body while wine was in my mind guiding me. And wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. And he goes and he recounts all the things he did pursuing pleasure. And then earlier, back up in chapter 1 and verse 16, he said, I said to myself, behold, I've magnified and increased wisdom more than all who are over Jerusalem before me. And my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. Here he also pursued knowledge and wisdom. And then later, when we get to chapter 2 and verse 12 and further, you can see the work, all the investment in the work that he's done, all the labor. But I want you to notice a couple of comments he makes about all that effort and energy he put into this pursuit. Look in verse 17. He said, this is chapter 2 and verse 17. He says, so I hated life. I hated life and the work which has been done under the sun. It was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after the wind. And verse 18, thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me. You have to see that God is factored out in all this. And Solomon is going after these things, these temporal things, with all his heart. He's trying to find happiness and fulfillment in things under the sun. And even in his seeking of pleasure, look how that worked out. Look in chapter 2, chapter 1, verse 10. Chapter 2, verse 10. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I didn't withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor. So momentarily he had some satisfaction. For my reward is this. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done, and the labor which I exerted, and behold, it was all vanity, and striving after the wind, and there is no profit under the sun. Solomon was disappointed in all of his pursuits, and he was frustrated, and he said, I hated life. And it was precisely because he tried so hard and he relied upon his own efforts that in the end he only achieved worry and strain. God is out, and he was trying to find happiness through his own efforts and his own abilities. What he needed to do was learn to be content. That was the recommendation that he had in chapter 4, verse 5 and 6. He said, the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. He's not recommending laziness. He's not trying to recommend we be lazy. He says, the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. But in verse 6, he says, one hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. Here's a guy that just, with two hands, he works and he labors and he labors, but he has no rest, no relaxation. He's just always stressed, trying to pursue it and accomplish it. He says, one hand of rest is far better than two hands full of work and labor that ends up burning you out. You ever heard the phrase, work your fingers to the bone and all you get is bony fingers? That's a phrase from a song years ago. He's not recommending laziness. And wisdom. He's not trying to say that we shouldn't attain wisdom and knowledge. Not putting that down. He's not saying you shouldn't study hard. Not saying you shouldn't go to school. But don't think that that's going to produce happiness. Sometimes the brain just tires out. There's no joy. There's no way to relax it. The mind is just constantly overloaded. And he learns through all of his knowledge. He said, all I learned was all the things I couldn't fix. I just learned more about how unjust the world was and how many crooked roads there were, and I learned how I can't straighten them out. The solution that he had back in chapter 2 in verse 24 and 25, there's nothing better for a man to eat than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor's good. This is all I've seen. And also, I have seen it from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without Him? The point is, God is the one who gives satisfaction. It is in God that we find contentment. It is not in the things that we can do with our hands in this world. Well, we're out of time. And I have one more point, so I'll make it in 30 seconds. He tells young people, at the end, and we've already read this, he says to the young people, rejoice, remove, and remember. Chapter 11, he says, for young man, he says, rejoice, enjoy your life, enjoy the good things, remove vexation from your heart, don't do things that are going to get you in trouble, don't do things that are going to ruin your life and bring you grief and pain and misery and such. And he says, remember, though, to prioritize. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Remember to prioritize God. Seek Him first. Because the days are going to come when you're going to say there's no joy in them. You're going to get old, really old, and you're not going to be able to do the things that you could do when you were younger. And you're going to look back and say, I could have served God when I was younger, but I was too busy with some other things. He says, you remember the Creator. Put Him first in the days of your youth. Because the days will come when you won't be able to do that. Well, again, should be a guarded lesson. The first time you read Eat, Drink, and Be Merry, that comes across very risky. And there are certainly abuses to that. And that parable that Jesus told about the rich man teaches us that we shouldn't make pleasures our God and enjoyment and entertainment. And that man loved them, he coveted them, and he was addicted to them. And that was bad news because God said, you're going to die this night. And what are you going to do with all those things? But He teaches us not to worry in this life, but to seek God first. And He will see that we have what we need. And sometimes even we'll have an abundance of things. And we should be content with those things and even use them to serve other people, bless other people. He gave us things not just for ourselves, but to share with those who are in need. Where is your treasure? Where is your heart? Where your treasure is, there your heart will be, Jesus said about that man who coveted the things of this life. We need to enjoy life that God has given us. Enjoy the gifts that He has given us. But He must be our God. He must dominate our heart. He must rule in our heart, because we cannot serve God and riches or pleasures or joy. Or entertainment. We need to have the good sense to be able to discern between the two and to know when we cross that line, when those things that are temporal are more important to us than the things that are eternal, and be able to back off of that and sacrifice those things so that we give our hearts fully to the Lord. Have you done that? Have you given your heart fully to God? Are you a follower of Jesus Christ? Maybe this morning you need to make that commitment. Maybe you've been a follower of pleasure and joy and entertainment and fun. And there's a place to repent from that too, and that may have to sell all of our possessions, like He told the rich young ruler. Those things are what dominates your heart. But we need to put Jesus first, follow, walk in His footsteps, and know that He is the way and the truth and the life, and no man comes to the Father except through Him. Commitment to Him and to His Word. Maybe this morning you'll be baptized, repent of your sins, confess Him to be the Lord. Believe in Him, trust in Him, not in the things that are in this world, not in yourself, but in the things of God. If we can help you obey the Lord this morning, be baptized into Him, then we would invite you to make that decision now while we sing our song. God.